David Foster Wallace is perhaps best known for his 1996 postmodern novel, Infinite Jest. Has anyone read all of Infinite Jest? All right, Ben, you started it? All right, good, good. Let me know. I'll check back with you in about 6 months. We'll see how it's going. Infinite Jest is famous for its length, weighing in at more than 1,000 pages, and its complexity. Its footnotes have footnotes. And I will confess to having started reading it once a few years ago, I asked my wife this morning, she's in the same situation, and then never quite finding the time to finish. I do hope to return to it someday. Wallace tragically committed suicide in 2008 at age 46 after a decades-long struggle with depression. He was beloved by many of the most important writers of our day, and his friend, the novelist Jonathan Franzen, described him as a huge talent, our strongest rhetorical writer, as sweet a person as I've ever known, and as tormented a person as I've ever known. In 2005, 3 years before his death, Wallace delivered the commencement address at Kenyon College. Has anyone heard that address? It's sort of circulated on the internet. It was titled, "This is Water, Some Thoughts Delivered on a Significant Occasion About Living a Compassionate Life." It's now been published as its own book, which, unlike Infinite Jest, has like only a few words on each page, so they could make it 144 pages, even though it's like 5 pages long. But on this Water Communion Sunday, I invite you to hear an excerpt of that famous speech. I'm only going to share about 20% of the speech with you this morning. So if this 20% interests you, I would encourage you to check the footnotes of the sermon that I'll post on our sermon manuscript on our website archive, and I'll include a link both to the full transcript as well as to a really wonderful 9-minute short film that's been made about some of the words of this film. That's really an excellent moving visualization. But for now, here are some of Wallace's words from 8 years ago. "There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods to them and says, 'Morning, boys, how's the water?' And the two young fish, they swim on for a bit, and eventually one of them looks over at the other and says, 'What the hell is water?' The immediate point of the fish story is that the most obvious, ubiquitous, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. And the really significant education isn't really about the capacity to think, but rather of the choice of what to think about. Here's one example of the utter wrongness of something I tend to be automatically sure of. Everything in my own immediate experience supports my deep belief that I am the absolute center of the universe, the realest, most vivid, important person in existence. We rarely talk about this sort of natural, basic self-centeredness. It's just our default setting. It's hardwired into our boards at birth. There's no experience you've ever had that you weren't the center of. People who can adjust their natural default setting of self-centeredness are often described as being well-adjusted, which I suggest to you is not an accidental term. They have adjusted that default setting." Now, Wallace goes on in that 80% of the speech that I don't have time to repeat for you this morning, to eloquently detail examples of the, quote, "boredom, routine, and petty frustration that characterize many parts of adult life, such as waiting in a grocery store line at the end of an already too long workday." He says, "My natural default setting is the certainty that such situations like this are all about me, about my hungriness, my fatigue, my desire to just get home, and it's going to seem for all the world like everyone else is just in my way. Who the hell are all these people? Why are they all in my way? And look at how repulsive most of them are. How stupid and cow-like and dead-eyed and non-human they seem to me here in this checkout line. How annoying and rude it is that people are talking loudly on their cell phones in the middle of the line. And look how deeply unfair this is. I've worked really hard all day, and I'm starved and tired, and I can't even get home to eat and unwind so that I can start the whole thing back over again in the morning because of all these stupid people. It's the automatic, unconscious way that I experience the boring, frustrated, crowded parts of adult life when I'm operating on the automatic, unconscious belief that I'm the center of the world and that my immediate needs and feelings are what should determine the world's priorities. The thing is that there are different ways to think about these kinds of situations. In this traffic, with all these vehicles stuck in my way, all these people who are just trying to get to a seat in the sanctuary, it's not impossible that some of these people in SUVs have been in horrible auto accidents in the past and now find driving so traumatic that their therapist has all but ordered them to get a huge, heavy SUV so they can feel safe enough to drive. Or that Hummer that just cut me off is maybe being driven by a father whose little child is hurt or sick in the seat next to him. He's trying to get to the hospital. He's in a way bigger, more legitimate hurry than I am, and it is actually I who am in his way. Or I can choose to force myself to consider the likelihood that everyone else in the supermarket's checkout line is just as bored and frustrated as I am, and that some of these people have probably much harder, more tedious lives, and more painful lives than I do. Now, if you've really learned how to think, how to pay attention, then you will know that you have other options other than your default setting. And the only thing that's capital T true is that you get to decide how you're going to see the world. You get to consciously decide what has meaning for you and what doesn't. The capital T truth is about life before death. It's about simple awareness of what is so real and so essential and so hidden in plain sight all around us that we have to keep reminding ourselves over and over that this is water. This is water. It is unimaginably hard to do this, to sustain it, to stay conscious and alive in our adult world day in and day out, which means yet another grand cliche turns out to be true. Your education is the job of a lifetime. It commences now, and I wish you way more than luck. So I invite you to consider that when Wallace says that this, all of this, is our water, he's referring to what we Unitarian Universalists call our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And as you've heard me say before, it has been suggested that we UUs would be well advised to switch our seventh principle with our first principle. They're written on the back of your order of service. Our first principle is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And as important as that is, the importance of individual freedom, at least for most people drawn to Unitarian Universalism, tends to be, in Wallace's words, our default setting. But Wallace reminds us that perhaps the most radical implications of that individual freedom is precisely the ability to choose to perceive not our independence from one another, that's easy, but our interdependence with one another, with the ecosystem of this earth, and even with this cosmos that we call the universe. Regarding that opening fish story, Wallace says that the most obvious, ubiquitous, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. And I invite you to consider that Wallace's insights about this is water also points us towards one of the deepest meanings of the Unitarian Universalist ritual known as water communion, which we will celebrate this morning. During the silent meditation, and don't worry, I've shortened the sermon. I'm aware of how long this is for the spoken meditation. During the silent meditation and the musical meditation, I invite you to reflect on the places in this world that have shaped you the most during the past year since we gathered last September to practice water communion. What are the places that have shaped you most in the past year? And if you had to select just one of those places that has shaped you in the past year from which to draw water, from which you have drawn wisdom and been shaped, what do you bring to this religious community as a result of being shaped by that place in the past year? And as you reflect on the places that have shaped you, remember that we are the fish in Wallace's parable. We are the stressed, and when we are stressed, anxious, and under pressure, we sometimes feel like we are all alone in the vast ocean of this world. But we're really swimming in a sea of interdependence. We're really swimming, always, already, in a sea of interdependence that we often fail to perceive. This is water. This is water. Just as we might draw up water from a well for sustenance, the places in our lives shape us. Pat Conroy famously wrote at the beginning of his book, Prince of Tides, that geography is my wound. It is also my anchorage, my port of call. The places in our lives, they shape us. They become part of us. And after the sermon, as I said earlier, there'll be an opportunity for any of you who feel led to come forward and pour water. If you brought water, you may bring water. I'm always impressed that people, if they actually remember to bring water for water communion. So good for all of you. Everything all right? All right, good. So good for all of you who brought water. If you didn't, we have a lovely purple pitcher up here that you can pour a little bit of water that it can be symbolic of that place for you. And so individuals will pour water into this larger bowl, and this ritual represents the way that this Unitarian Universalist community draws truth from many different sources, and that each of you are part of that, of shaping this community with all that you bring from your experience. And to continue to reflect on the ways that all these diverse sources of water and wisdom are related and interdependent, I would invite us to consider that briefly from three angles: scientific, Buddhist, and Christian. From a scientific perspective, Mark Nepo has written that water reflects everything that it encounters. This is so commonplace that water reflects everything it encounters that we think that water is blue, when in fact it has no color. And that noticing resonates with Wallace's fish story from earlier, that the most obvious, ubiquitous, important realities are often the ones that are hardest to see and talk about. And for Nepo, the wisdom underneath his noticing, so obvious that water is not blue but has no color, is that like water, seeing water can be an opportunity to embrace everything clearly, without imposing who we are, but also without losing who we are. While reflecting on the true blue of the sky, water still retains its own essence. So whenever Nepo sees water, he says he tries to remind himself to practice a healthy compassion, to embrace everything clearly, without imposing who we are, but also without losing who we are. From a Buddhist perspective, I invite you to recall what it felt like this morning to sing that opening song, which invited each of us to move through three stages of awareness. From the first person singular of, may I be filled with loving kindness. May I be well, peaceful, and at ease, and whole. To the second person singular, may you be filled with loving kindness. May you be well, peaceful, at ease, and whole. And finally, to the first person plural, may we be filled with loving kindness. Can I get a shout out for my grammar nerds out there so that they can appreciate this that shift to first person plural? In the Buddhist tradition, this chant is known as a metta meditation, M-E-T-T-A, from the Pali word meaning loving kindness or friendliness. And friendliness is another one of those commonplace things that I think we take for granted sometimes. But it is no easy thing to make a friend of someone, a true friend that you can be authentic and vulnerable with. And a metta meditation is a way of doing that. It's a way of taking anyone you might encounter and trying to become friends with them through metta. And each stage of this meditation is vital. The times when we find ourselves burned out, overscheduled, doing so much for others that we neglect self-care, those are the times that we need to return to that first person singular, that focus on loving kindness to ourselves and for ourselves and with ourselves. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be whole. At the same time, the meditation intentionally builds in ever-expanding concentric circles to the all the way up to the first person plural that includes loving kindness both for ourselves. We're in that we. Me is in that we. Both for ourselves and for all beings. May we be well, peaceful, at ease, and whole. The move here is from focusing on a healthy independence for yourself to a more mature and healthy interdependence, which also includes a healthy self. And the reason that this metta, loving kindness chant, was written in the first place is to use David Foster Wallace's term, our default setting is neither to be peaceful and at ease. You know, evolutionarily, our default setting is to beware lest a predator come and eat us, and then we wouldn't be able to reproduce. So our default setting is not to be at peaceful and at ease. It's to be aware and fearful and anxious. Nor is it to feel in solidarity with all existence. We're all born little egocentric narcissists, and then hopefully we get socialized into interdependence. Our default setting is narcissism, and we need practices like loving kindness meditations to help inculcate, to help groove paths in our neural pathways to a different, healthier, more expansive way of being in the world. And returning to David Foster Wallace's grocery store scenario, let me give you one more example of what he means. He writes that most days, if you're aware enough to give yourself a choice, you can choose to look differently at this dead-eyed, over-made-up lady who just screamed at her kid in the checkout line. Maybe she's not usually like this. Maybe she's been up three nights holding the hand of her husband who's dying of bone cancer. Maybe this very lady is the low-wage clerk at the motor vehicles department who just yesterday helped your spouse resolve a horrific, infuriating, red-taped problem through some small act of bureaucratic kindness. Of course, none of this is likely. But it's also not impossible. It just depends on what you want to consider. And if you're automatically sure that you know exactly how reality is, and you're operating on your default setting, then you, like me, probably won't consider possibilities that aren't annoying and that aren't miserable. But if you really learn to pay attention, you'll know that there are other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell-type situation, not only as meaningful, but as sacred, as on fire with the same force that made the stars, love, fellowship, the mystical oneness of all things deep down. Not that all that mystical stuff is necessarily completely true. The only thing that's capital T true, as far as I know, is that you get to decide how you're going to see it. To echo this sentiment from a Christian perspective, I think that most people misunderstand the deep meaning underneath what Jesus called the second greatest commandment, which is to love your neighbor as yourself. Most people fail in their attempts to love their neighbors as themselves because they are operating from a first-person singular or a second-person singular perspective. They are operating from their default perspective in which yourself and your neighbor are two separate, independent individuals. And the challenge is to shift your way of perceiving the world from first-person singular or even second-person singular to first-person plural, from independence to interdependence, to experience that at the deepest level, your neighbor is yourself. And it is only from that place of existentially experiencing the interdependent web of all existence that you will find yourself able to authentically say and live the words of that third verse, "May we be filled with loving kindness, and we includes me. May we be well. May we be peaceful and at ease. May we be whole." And on that deepest level of realized, experiential interdependence, you know for yourself what is so real and essential and so hidden in plain sight all around us that we have to keep reminding ourselves over and over, this is water. This is water. Maybe some of you could feel it a little bit, how we can transform our experience when Laura was leading that earlier, that you can, by shifting the way you're thinking, experience connectedness, experience water. I invite you to continue to reflect on what that feels like, what you've experienced, if any part of the interdependent web this morning, as you continue to reflect on our place within that global we, this interdependent web. Reflect on these things.